Tensor Network Renormalization Flow to these models. And but you have these more complicated models, and it's very easy to have an initial bond dimension. You can make it as bad as you want, over a million. No, and of course, you don't want to compute with a million indices. Okay, so what is the range of tricks that you can actually compute with 1 million? You will learn that in the colloquium.
Tutorial.
In the tutorial, sorry. So we will take a number of steps. Okay, as we have seen, it's good to protect the symmetry and to build it into the algorithm instead of trusting that it will be preserved. Because in fact, as far as I know, if you make it's an unstable symmetry. Once you away it will actually run away completely from the symmetry, and then you are in this huge space and completely lost. So that in particular means that you use the split of the tensor into free data and symmetry determined structure, because that saves computational time and memory. And this free data also means that you use really the coupling rules to avoid wasting memories on things which vanish and to add up things which vanish. Again, we have all done these things. So it makes a huge difference whether you do this or not. Here it's the conceptual most interesting sense, because you can actually use this observable, which is a total spin, to characterize your phases and your fixed point tensors and the flow. And now comes maybe the most subtle step. And you have learned, sorry, I should have done this. You have seen this algorithm, which we have also used for a long time. And you see that in principle you use these four-valent tensors. But in between you use these three-valent tensors. But you do something very funny. You first glue four-valent, three-valent tensors, four of these, and in the next, then you have these, and then you split them again. So are you doing something too much? And the answer is yes. It's completely unnecessary to do that. There's just an exact reorganization of this algorithm that you only need to use three-valent tensors. And going from three-valent, going to four-valent to three-valent again makes a huge difference, because roughly either you have to work with, you know, bond dimension to the four object or bond dimension to the three object. And if your bond dimension is, okay, not maybe a million, but 1,000, it is a factor of 1,000. And this is a bit described here. So instead of using these plaquettes, you use these triangles, which are still in principle glued to plaquettes. And what you do is to glue two of these triangles to a larger triangle, to this triangle. Now you could complain, okay, but here you still have two indices, and in fact, there's a procedure which is very similar to the splitting procedure, which summarizes these two indices to one index. This procedure is actually exactly this phi which I had before. It's this embedding map which also gives you a truncation, etc. Okay, let me just go through it in slightly more detail. Again, Sebastian might explain it again in the tutorial. So symmetry protection means that you never touch this structure. You actually, we will see it coming up, but this is basically analytically given in some sense. You only flow these are almost free data. This J index, we have seen that you have a fifth spin. It's something like the total spin of these two spins. So it's already some kind of observable of summarizing two edges to one. And in fact, it is an interesting observable, and it means that in the splitting procedure, or in this procedure to compute the embedding map, this matrix, which we usually have to split, already comes in a block form. And so we need only to do things per block. And so we get actually much more fine-grained information. We not only get the lambdas, but we get the lambdas, these singular values, labeled by a spin. And again, that tells us in which phase we are. So here I said these things vanish if the coupling rules are not satisfied. So you can use some trick to actually just save data which corresponds to a priori non-vanishing indices, and that's to introduce super indices. Again, you can make an exercise and see that this saves a lot of data. Lastly, we will see that the gluing, we will only glue these T's. Unfortunately, it's not so simple. You have just to glue these parts, but what will happen is that this structure will be convoluted into the gluing. And we will see that in this slide. So what you can do is you can write kind of a renormalization flow equation. So in principle, here you have these two steps you usually have, which is splitting and gluing. So this equation is a gluing. And here, implicitly, there's a splitting, because here you get these two tensors from splitting your input tensor. So you get you take your T, you split it into these two tensors. And then here you have lots of so-called recoupling symbols. These all come from contracting these symmetry determined structure. So unfortunately, that makes the contraction a bit more complicated, because what you have to sum is over certain spins here. The example I've written down is already actually for this case with four copies of the symmetry group. So if you had just one copy, this would be the triangular algorithm with just one 6J symbol. And the rest are just factors, which of course is important to get right to get the useful fixed points. So that's what you have to implement in the end. Let me mention the last step for this triangular algorithm, last point. And you could have said, but in between in this algorithm, I form a four-valent tensor. That's where we glue two triangles together, because you take one of these triangles, you kind of take the one with the opposite orientation, you glue these two, and then you have these four-valent ones. And so you could claim, oh, you are as good as before. But in this case, actually, Sebastian came up with a funny reorganization, which tells you that, in fact, you never need to save the full four-valent tensor here. What you can do is you can do these two steps for each separate J, where J is this funny overline J is a recoupling channel, which you can get here in computing this embedding map. So what you always just need to save at each step is a block for a fixed J. You compute this, then you can forget about it, because here you form the three-valent tensor, and then you can compute it again. So that means here I have this table that you can actually save a factor of, in this case, 100. If I'm not too wrong, because here you can compare the size of T in gigabyte for different sizes of your initial model, and you can compare the size of the largest block in gigabyte. But in general, it tells you, how the size of these tensors is increasing. If you increase the so-called level K, and this level K translates into the number of maximal, the maximal spin you can have. And this is all for the case where you already take four copies of this group. So taking the fourth power, of course, gives you large numbers. but I think we went until K to the 8 or 10, so you are here. And all these sizes are already taking into account just the free data, and the coupling rules, I believe. So this is just the result. If you already take in the coupling rules and the free data, And already the coupling rules for the smallest k factor here, you know, saving all things with zeros or saving just the things which satisfy the coupling rules, gives you a factor of 1,000. The slightly annoying thing is that the coupling rules are a bit more complicated to implement. In this case, it's not too complicated. But a priori, it's kind of a bit non-local. So in these models, it's still easy. But you see, for k equal to 4, it's 1,000, and it grows. So if you would still take the magnetic indices into it, you get really a factor of a million. You should not do that. It's not that people propose to do that. Not for this 2D thing, but for the 3D thing. Then they were still speaking about the Ising model, but in principle it was a bit ridiculous. Okay. I forgot how much time I have in principle, like 45, yeah. So this gives you just really an indication that you should be a bit, think a bit before you do your algorithm, or do it like us. You just try, and later on you find out how stupid you have been. But in each step, we could do more and more complicated models. What has been here, the underlying theme a bit is, is that we used also an observable, which was this coupling channel J, and indeed in practice it gave us lots of information. And the other thing is that we didn't want to compute things which were kind of useless to compute, and this was determined by the global structure. So now let's go to higher dimensions and models with gauge symmetries, and this theme will be even more important here. To explain that, we have first to make tensor networks more flexible. And so we made them more flexible and called it decorated tensor networks. And the main point is here indeed to allow you in direct access to observables, and observables which might actually be preserved by the symmetry. it's not necessarily given by these models, so okay. We have seen the tensor networks in 2D, and they define a particular model, and sometimes these models are called edge models. So you can define them with these kind of, usually I call it dual lattice, or you can define them geometrically by going to the lattice dual to this tensor network structure. And what you do here is you glue these plaquettes by summing over variables which are associated to the edges, that is to the boundary of these plaquettes. So this is a particular structure. Now, Giffrey has shown us a trick that you can basically write every 2D model with some tricks into the structure. But then, usually in these methods, you never care about what these variables are. There are lots of gauge transformations. There are lots of rewriting the tensors into equivalent models. So the slight disadvantage of completely ignoring what these tensors are is that you lose a lot of useful information. And there are lots of transformations going on in the algorithm. So what you get in the end, the variables you get in the end, might not have anything to do with your original variables. So here is another possibility, another class of models. In this case, you would have models associated to the vertices of your boundaries. And this happens in the Ising model a priori in the Ising model. It happens in the scalar field. You would associate these variables to the vertices. So that means, in particular, if you glue four squares, you know what you have to. What happens is that you have one variable per vertex, which you have to sum over. So one variable is shared by four objects. So there are different ways of gluing things. The tensor networks always kind of require that you glue two things. And so what we said is, let's keep these structures. Let's keep maybe these variables at the vertices. Let's consider the case that I glue four squares. What I get is now a bigger square. But I do get now these variables on the edges of the bigger square, because these come from identifying, you know, from these variables which used to live at these corners. But now I can do this following. I can still keep these edges, these variables at the corner of my big square, g1, g2, g3, g4. But I can just understand these variables are some abstract tensor indices. So it's just a real labeling. So we will call these variables decorations. And this will still define you a tensor network, which is kind of trivial for the zeros iteration, but then it becomes bigger and bigger if you don't throw anything away. So if you put more and more of these together, you do basically get, you know, a tensor network here. You can summarize all these variables you have on this long edge then into a tensor network with lots of variables. So that's the thick edge here. But you still have these original variables. So if you imagine it's a spin, so you still have the four spins. They might be very far away. But the tensor you get will directly tell you, you know, the expectation value for these spins. And actually, if you glue it together, okay, you get just one spin, but you get indirect access to these spins. And so you can again monitor more directly the faces. The point is that indeed you can also come up with almost the same algorithm we had for these decorated tensor networks. Now there is happening something which actually also happened in the symmetry protected models, and this is that these decorations, they will lead to a block structure, again for the SVD. So we can, of course, make use of that block structure for the SVD. But otherwise, it's a very similar procedure. So we can take again a square and split that in two different ways and glue it to a bigger square and so on. And what you see is that these decorations, in each step, some part of these decorations is turned into really these abstract tensor indices. So this is just the square version. You can again reorganize it to triangular version if you want to. The upshot being here, we have a chance to make our tensor networks more flexible, keeping some observables, and this will be important if you consider gauge theories. So gauge theories have one very important thing you should think about if you want to do tensor networks for gauge theories, which is, as the name suggests, they're unphysical gauge degrees of freedom, and for certain you don't want to deal with them in your algorithm and sum over these unphysical degrees of freedom. Gauge theory means that now it's not just global symmetry, but there's even much more, because you have basically the gauge group at each node of your lattice. This is the point that you just want to work with the physical information in your course training. And the other point is that indeed gauge invariant information is encoded in spin networks. And you might want to preserve some observables which describe these spin networks, which would be actually the spins. And in the case of spin forms, this has even an interesting geometric interpretation. And you hope also that it actually coarse grains in a geometric way. And this is what we actually discussed in the symmetry protected algorithms, where we say it's a total spin. We can interpret as the total length of our plaquettes. And in fact, we can basically take this idea of decorated tensor networks and lift it to higher dimensions. And here is this 3D case, a gauge theory in 3D. So what the decoration one chooses here are these spin networks. You don't need to define them in completely here. What you need to know is just these are really gauge invariant information. These spins are the same spins as Benjamin had, and he had basically also a spin network labels on his hypercubes. So here we have a spin network around a cube. Again, you should use the fact that these spin networks, in principle, vanish for lots of choices of your labels on the spin network. If you work with abelian groups, for instance, you have lots of edges here, apparently 18. So there are 18 links. So these edges would be labeled by representation of the group. So it's not, but if in fact for an abelian group, the entire allowed configurations are just given by choosing labels on 7 of these links. So you save a factor of chi to the 11. Again, that's a lot. It was for the abelian case, you go from chi to the 18 to chi to the 7. We will see that these prisms will come up because roughly this algorithm now, the nice thing is that you can do a version which we had in 2D. You can take these cubes, each of these cubes here, there are 4 cubes, you can split them in 2 different ways. You get these funny prisms, you glue these prisms together, and you get a new cube. Now you could ask, we had this triangular algorithm before, and you can ask, can we reorganize it? Unfortunately, I mean, we tried. You can write smaller things for even the regular letters. It's a reorganization, but it's not an exact mapping. So you actually get a less accurate algorithm this way. But in principle, you can think about these things. So, but this would be a more complicated version due to the higher dimensions. So you have actually different kinds of building blocks, like a prisms and pyramids or something, or prisms and tetrahedra, actually. sorry, that was me doing this. Okay. So, in principle, is this, if you work out the details, it can be a bit more complicated. And Clermont is very excited to tell you more about it. That's how excited he is. So here you see one step in this algorithm where indeed you consider the spin network on top of this. And these different edges mean gauge fixed edges versus free data. And you have to be careful in writing down your algorithm to carefully glue things together and count things correctly and identify things and then define your splitting procedure and then glue again everything together. again, so the just to summarize the features of this model, so it's a more complicated version of the 2D version. The decorations here is given by a boundary spin network. The spin network, in principle, has a really geometric information. It tells you the geometry of this building block. And if you do this coarse-graining algorithm, indeed you change the geometry. And correspondingly, you coarse-grain somehow the glued spin networks to a coarser spin network. But this coarse-graining, actually, you expect corresponds to geometric coarse-graining. So in fact, you keep basically the geometric observables in this procedure. And for that reason, all these splitting procedures and you get singular values, this gives you exact access to interesting information on how intertwinner degrees of freedom flow, and this is the most relevant information for the spin forms. And there's probably much more things you can say about that, because you can go to refinements, and that can be either encoded in a tensor network structure or in refined, more complicated boundary spin networks. But you will very fast run in these problems, which is to save this huge amount of data, basically. Which maybe you should not be surprised, because one building block can be large. So what you want to save is the possibility that your building block is as small as possible, basically Planck size. But the spins tell you the size of the building block. So you basically get the amplitude for a universe, which can be any size. Okay, so for abelian models, it worked reasonably well. Then we considered non-abelian models, and this is the first time that we could really implement the key ingredient of spin for models, namely non-trivial intertwiner degrees of freedom. And so I think still the main question is here, do we actually flow to new TQFTs, that is new fixed points we don't know? And can we understand these intertwiner degrees of freedom? Do they lead to new phases? That's basically, I have to say new phases in addition to lattice gauge theory, because the spin form model space is much bigger as what you would consider for standard lattice gauge theories. And unfortunately, it has also much more parameters. And the main question is first to get an understanding of what's the influence of these degrees, new degrees of freedom in addition to lattice gauge theory is on these, you know, possible long range physics. So previously, I advertised to you, oh, for these non-abelian models, the decorations given by boundary spin networks give you interesting observables, and they can cause grain in a geometric way. And nobody complained. Okay, but actually, there's one deep problem here, because these spin networks, they do describe you piecewise flat geometry. Now you coarse grain, and you want to describe basically things in an effective building block. But this effective building block doesn't need to be piecewise flat anymore. I mean, it doesn't need to be flat anymore. It could carry curvature. Indeed, it's what you expect if you put a cosmological constant, then even kind of vacuum, you would get a homogeneous curvature. And then the spin networks, at least the undeformed ones, are not anymore a good way to describe the situation. And you see this in this little exercise. So assume you have your boundary spin network, and there's one configuration which is given by these spins. So remember that there are coupling rules here, and the coupling rules apply to the nodes of this network, and so these coupling rules are triangle inequalities, and all these couplings are satisfied. Coupling rules are satisfied. So in particular, you have triangle inequalities, which tells you that the sum of any two sides or any two edges going in here needs to be bigger or equal to the other side. So 0 plus 1 half is equal to 1 half, that's fine. But if you coarse grain, in some sense, you would like to summarize this blob here into one node, into one new node. And if you do that, you keep with these outer edges 0, 1, 0. And is this coupling rule here satisfied?
No.
It's not satisfied. 0 plus 0 is not bigger or equal than 1. And in fact, it's due to curvature you could a priori have. If you don't have curvature, if you're flat, you don't have this problem. But if you have curvature, you get a non-vanishing amplitude for this kind of coarse grain spin network on your boundary. But if you have curvature, this might appear. And it indicates kind of a violation of the coupling rule, which are actually coming from Gauss constraints. And in fact, if you have curvature, it requires a deformation of Gauss constraints, as we kind of understood, not only we, but as was understood in a couple of very mathematical works. You could also say curvature leads to torsion. That just means that there is a surprising enlargement of your space of models you flow in. And if, in fact, this could be relevant for spin foams. And the four slides which were left before the fire alarm nicely interrupted us. And I was presenting this algorithm for gauge series in higher dimensions. So we actually implemented it both for abelian and non-abelian models. And the point was to use this decorated tensor network algorithm, which allowed you to keep some observables. And in the abelian case, it worked nicely. In the non-abelian case, we did have to do some projection. Let me just tell you again why we are kind of interested in the non-abelian models. So these are the first ones where you can really test the key ingredient of spinform models, namely non-trivial intertwiner degrees of freedom. And so the main questions we can actually address with these techniques: are there new fixed points, phases which you can see with these spinform models beyond lattice gauge theory phases? And to understand really the intertwiner, the dynamical behavior and also the coarse-graining behavior of these new intertwiner degrees of freedom, because that's a key ingredient of these spinform models. Then, as I already started shortly to mention, these spin networks, in principle, we expect them to coarse-grain nicely, but they actually do not really coarse-grain nicely. And there is a geometric reason behind these things. So what we did in the work we actually produced with Clément was to project really onto proper spin networks which satisfy these coupling rules. But this is expected only to work if you make an assumption, namely that you are not in a curvature dominated, you are not curvature dominated, and really you're interested in ending up in flat space. But you have to be careful because you put in basically that, to some degree, that you look to flat space. So this is the problem, and this was a picture that shows you that these boundary spin networks, if you want to use them as observables, it's not ideal. You have to project something. And again, there's a geometric reason behind that, which is really indeed related to lots of ongoing work by other people, for instance, et al. Levine, to understand how you could possibly parameterize building blocks with an effective curvature in it. Okay, so there are interesting things to do, which is even on this level of keeping observables. And so you could think about replacing the spin network decoration, basically the spin networks, which are a decoration for these tensor networks, and keep your observables and coarse grains, basically the observables you're interested in, on this level. So they would be giving you the coarsest possible shape of your large, of your building block, which in principle is glued from lots of small building blocks. But you could replace it with a structure which is more adapted to coarse graining. And in fact, there is such a structure. It's a new structure, so you might not have heard of it. It's called a fusion basis, and it encodes curvature and torsion degrees of freedom on all scales. It could be an advantage indeed if you are really starting with something which is peaked on flat space, for instance. These curvature degrees of freedom will be highly peaked. So could even be a better parameterization for what you want to do. And so this is just opening the possibility that, in fact, we still have to figure out what I mentioned, what are good choice of observables, what are good parameterizations for our models. Because here, we might be doing much better or much worse. Interestingly, this fusion basis basically has already inbuilt a coarse-graining scheme in itself. So here you could do things without doing this projection. Possibly really look at, for instance, this question of implementing a cosmological constant and then check, do you flow to a fixed point? And that would be even mathematically really highly interesting, because it's a question whether you can flow from something which has inbuilt something in, which is SC2, to a quantum group, which basically people somehow try to argue for some time, actually, including us, that this might happen. Okay, so this is actually my last slide. So being the message being, tensor networks seem to be indeed promising. You have to maybe make them more flexible to allow for more complicated models, especially for higher dimensions. So it is a huge challenge, actually. So we did 3D models. I'm looking for courageous people doing 4D models. They have a number of advantages, which even, you know, if you ignore that, it is automatically a huge space you are flowing in. You have a dynamically determined cutoff. So you can, even if you can't do the full algorithm, you can already test a bit what are good observables to keep and so on. So in this case, choose as decorations observables that you believe are the most relevant for your system and test your assumption. There's even a lot to do before implementing the full algorithm. And so these will be the next steps to find the best geometric observables to control your coarse graining flow and approximation. And then you can decide how many PhD students correspond to these dots. And, you know, so then it's basically to really test the large-scale behavior of spin forms and possibly find new phases and understand what is this mechanism. So really, my vision would be in lattice gauge theory, you know, actually back in the 70s, there was a conjecture and there's only two phases. And since then, we try to test, is this conjecture true or not? And it's actually lots of hard work, but we are in spin forms, we are not even at this level. So is there something more interesting happening in spin forms? And that would be the first question. Okay, so that finishes my actual talk. And next, Sebastian will basically give his tutorial and not a colloquium.